Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Grasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, today I want to begin in probably in the second half of the show talking about a topic that is kind of a spinoff of the show we had a couple of weeks ago where we talked about labor's great detour. What's happened to union labor in particular, but the labor working class in general since the beginning of neoliberalism in the late 70s, early 80s. And I'm not going to repeat those arguments and, those propositions about why labor has been in a great detour, and that was a retreat of sorts. And in the show, I talked about, is it coming out of that detour? You know, we have the UPS negotiations, which it looks like the Teamsters are going to come out ahead on that, 350,000 truck drivers. Looks like there's a tentative agreement there. And the significant thing about the Teamster negotiation, there's no concessions. You see, the Great Detour has been characterized by major chronic concessions by workers and their unions to management and the companies. Concessions meaning retreats, giving up what they had gained in previous decades. I mentioned the decade of the 70s, the early 70s, where we had massive gains by unions, 20-25% gains in wages and benefits and contracts for the major unions there in construction and manufacturing and transport. And that's why Nixon's wage freeze was imposed, because the companies couldn't stop it. But then they gathered their forces in the 70s, and what we got with neoliberalism was a take back and a retreat of labor over 40 years. And of course, that retreat is measured by massive loss of union membership in the private sector in particular. And then that brings us back up to where we were or are here this year. And the question I raised in the show a couple of weeks ago was, are we at the end of that great detour, and is labor coming back? Well, the Teamsters certainly look like they've at least, if not reversed it, at least stopped it. The railroad workers last year tried to, but of course they got slapped down by the Biden-Pelosi administration with anti-strike legislation. The West Coast longshore workers, for the first time, bargained without a contract for months, but that's pending, if not already ratified. They never got into the concession game, one of the few unions that was able to resist it. And then we have the writer's strike, the writer and actor's strike, which is not just about money, but about jobs and the destruction of actual jobs coming because of technology and artificial intelligence. That's what that fight's about. We will probably have to have a show separately on that topic. It's that important. And it kind of harkens back to a show I had a month or two ago about artificial intelligence versus the working class, and a take on the Goldman Sachs research that predicted 300 million jobs would be lost. Well, the writers-actor strike is at the tip of that spear. So that deserves a discussion in and of itself. Maybe next week we'll see. Will they come back, in other words? And there are other negotiations going on here and there. It looks like labor is attempting to stop the bloodletting of 40 years under neoliberalism and neoliberal industrial policy, which has been to devastate the unions and to keep wages down, compressed, as they say. And to shift the cost of benefits more and more to workers. That's a neoliberal industrial policy, as I call it, as well as privatization and deindustrialization and so forth. offshoring of jobs. That's all part of neoliberal industrial policy, which is still very strong, even under existing Democrat Biden administration. It's still quite successful. In another show, I talked about how neoliberal policies in other areas are really weakening and under growing contradiction. Fiscal policy, monetary policy, and external policy. Well, I'm not going to repeat those main arguments today, although at the end of the show, we'll see how the crisis of neoliberal policies in fiscal and monetary areas is really related to the topic that I'm going to jump into right now. Okay. And that topic is the decision that occurred this past week by a company called Fitch, F-I-T-C-H, Fitch. It's one of the big three credit rating agencies. In other words, these credit rating agencies make decisions based upon the financial stability of corporations and governments and government sectors, by the way. In other words, can they pay their bills? What is their costs? Are they losing money, et cetera? What's their market strength, so forth? These three credit rating agencies, of Fitch's one, are very important because if they downgrade a they have a levels of grading. The top grading is AAA. Below that is AA+, and then AA, and then A, and then BBB. Now, BBB is junk. Junk bonds, junk loans, CLOs, and so forth. So if you're BBB, and even just an A, you have to pay more interest when you borrow money. In other words, you're not as financially stable. You're riskier. So whoever wants to loan you money because you are more risk can charge you a higher interest rate. So these ratings by Fitch and others are important because they raise the cost of borrowing. If you got a low rating, or if your rating is reduced. And as I said, it's not just corporations that get rated by Fitch and the others. It's also government entities and private entities. Okay, so what did Fitch do this past week? Well, horror of horrors, it downgraded the U.S. government. The U.S. government had for as long as people could tell, I think since the Great Depression at least, a triple A rating, the top rating. In other words, the U.S. government can't go broke here. You know, it can always raise taxes to pay its bills or even print money to pay its bills. So the U.S. government was safe, 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 particularly its securities, the treasuries. You know, the very short-term treasuries called treasury bills, the median-term treasuries called notes, treasury notes, and then the 10-year, 20, 30-year called bonds, treasury bonds. They were always rated AAA. Well, Fitch really shook up the industry here by downgrading the U.S. government from AAA to AA+. What that means is that the Fed has to raise interest rates. Now, wait a minute, stop. Hold on a minute here, right? Doesn't the Fed raise interest rates to deal with inflation, to try to slow down the economy by raising rates, which cause companies' costs to rise and therefore they lay off workers, and the workers get laid off, then they don't have as much income, and demand for goods and services declines, and therefore inflation declines. You know, that's the argument that we think about here, or the Fed raises rates. You know, whether it's successful or not is another question. I'll talk about that shortly, but it raises interest rates to deal with inflation. Well, wait a minute. It now has to raise interest rates higher because its rating has collapsed. Well, I wouldn't say collapsed, but has been cut. No one knows the long-term effects of that rating decline, but there's a lot of heartburn going on in the financial sector about the government rating being cut by Fitch. What it means is that interest rates are going to continue to rise here. Whether or not the Fed actually raises its short-term rates, because the markets, the industry, will factor in this development of the rating decline. There's another force here we'll talk about at the end of the show, why interest rates will continue to rise. Okay, let's continue with Fitch, right? Why did Fitch do this? Why did Fitch make this decision to downgrade U.S. government and its treasuries, deficits, and debt? You know, debt, the national debt, is just the accumulation of annual deficits. And what's the deficit going to be this year? Again, 2023 fiscal year. Oh, it's going to be well over another $1 trillion, maybe $1.5 trillion. Just in the 3 or 4 months, I think, since the so-called debt ceiling deal, remember that? We talked about that a lot here. The deficit has increased, I've been told, by $800 billion more. Well, wasn't the debt ceiling deal about dealing with that? No, the debt ceiling deal, even though it cut social spending programs significantly, has not solved the runaway deficits, annual deficits, that the U.S. is experiencing. Yeah. Now, as interest rates rise, right, the government, the Fed in this case, its costs rise. The costs, in other words, it has to offer higher interest rates to investors and borrowers, which are mostly banks and capitalists, right? It has to offer higher interest rates, so its costs rise. In other words, the interest on the U.S. debt increases as the debt itself increases in magnitude, because deficits are $1.5 trillion every year, right? Look, our total national debt back in 2000, was about $6 trillion. And that had risen from less than $1 trillion in the previous 20 years. In other words, the national debt in 1980-81 was about $1 trillion. In the next 20 years, that had risen to about $6 trillion. But since then, since 2000, it's risen to $34 trillion. That's the national debt. In other words, the deficits have gotten bigger and have been chronic now for at least 15 years. Well, what's going on? Why are the deficits so chronic and so difficult to reduce? Well, you know, deficits are a budget deficit we're talking about here, are a function of the revenue you bring in and the spending that you make. And if you look at those two variables in the last 20 years, what do you see? Well, you see chronic tax cuts for the rich and corporations. I've done some calculations since 2001 when Bush started his tax cuts, and they've cut $15 trillion in taxes in the last 20 years, 15 trillion, well, 22 years now, 15, and most of that is for corporations and investors and the wealthy 1%. So they've cut taxes. At the same time, tax revenues are also a function of whether the economy is growing robustly or not. And since the 2008-09 crash, the economy has not been growing robustly. Under Obama, it grew only about two-thirds of what is normal after a recession. So it's been slow, sluggish growth even when it's growing. And then, of course, we hit COVID, and the economy falls into a tank for 2 years. Well, that means tax revenue really fell off. Right? And now we've got growth coming out of COVID, the first year, 2022, of only 1% GDP from December to December. I've talked about this before, but, you know, the media doesn't cover this very well. Right? They don't want to talk about it. They say, oh, you know, in the last quarter, it grew 2.4% GDP, the economy, 2.4%. Well, first of all, it didn't grow 2.4% in the quarter. It grew about 0.5%. But they always annualize it. They multiply it by four quarters, you know, in the U.S. make it look good. Oh, we're growing 2.4%. But if you look at December 31st to December 31st, year to year, 2021 to 2022, a 1% net GDP growth. And that followed $8 trillion in fiscal monetary stimulus during COVID. A 1% growth. And the Fed this year continues to forecast another 1% growth. 1% growth. That doesn't generate sufficient tax revenues in addition to continuing the $4.5 trillion Trump tax cuts of 2018. That's $4.5 trillion over a decade. And on top of that, last year, or 2022, you got Biden. Much of his three bills, $1.65 trillion in investment subsidies, are really subsidies, in other words, a form of tax cut for the corporations. Yeah. So with this massive tax cutting going on, no wonder we got these chronic deficits every year, on top of which we have runaway defense war spending, on top of which. You take that away. Well, how much did we waste in the Middle East? The $7 trillion, according to Brown University estimates, $7 trillion thrown away down a rat hole in those wars in the Middle East. And now we got another bigger rat hole going in Ukraine. And we're digging another third rat hole preparing for war with China. Defense spending, war spending going through the roof. Pentagon spending $850 billion. Latest measure, that doesn't count about $75 billion in off-budget, black budget spending on new advanced weapons. That doesn't show up in the printing of the budget, you see, but it's there. So over $900 billion just at the Pentagon, but that's not the whole picture, because defense spending, there's a lot of nooks and crannies where other defense spending occurs that's not in the Pentagon. Veteran spending and, you know, energy department spending. The biggest consumer of oil in the world is the U.S. military. And that's in the energy department budget. That's not in a Pentagon budget. Okay? And then, of course, $200 billion thrown away at Ukraine so far and more coming. Well, who knows how much, because every time we audit the Defense Department, trillions are unaccounted for. Yeah, so we really don't know what war spending and defense spending really is, but we know a minimal amount that gets reported, at least $1.1 trillion. Over half of our discretionary budget spending in the United States is on war and defense. Well, that has an impact on the deficits. At the same time, that tax revenues aren't growing sufficiently. Well, the two factors that determine your deficit are out of whack. Both of them are contributing to the deficit of $1 trillion every year for as long as we can see. And you know, they didn't think too much of that when interest rates were super low. Quantitative easing, you know, the Fed after 2008 dropped interest rates to virtually zero, right? That means the Fed did not have to pay higher costs to sell its bonds, its treasury bonds, to cover this budget deficit. It didn't have to do that. But now, when inflation rising and they're raising interest rates, the Fed raising interest rates, you know, to try to dampen inflation. Well, now the Fed has to pay a lot more. How much more? Well, in 2020, I think it was, maybe it was 2019, the total interest on the debt cost of the U.S. government was about $250 billion, thereabouts. Even though the Fed had been borrowing so much to deal with, the Great Recession and the crash, and for 8 years, but interest rates were zero. Didn't have to pay much for it. But now it's paying 4 or 5%, 5.25%, 5.5%. Yeah. Well, the interest on the debt payment annual in 2019 was like $250 billion. You know what it is now? It's more than $600 billion. And in a few more years, it's going to $900 billion. Now, who is that payment to? Oh, that's to investors who buy bonds and notes and so forth for the government. Doesn't go to you and me. Yeah, so they're making a lot of money off the U.S. government and its debt caused by making money by not paying taxes. Yeah, they get two bites of the apple, you see. So annual deficits, over $1 trillion and rising, accumulate into the national debt, which is $34 trillion now. Estimates by 2030 are going to be like $43 trillion. And that means $1 trillion plus a year, just interest on the debt. Yeah, just interest. Well, now, what does that mean? That means if the government only has like I think it's like $3 trillion plus whatever, discretionary revenues to pay for everything, all its costs, including the $1 trillion plus defense war spending. If it only has $3 trillion, but it has to spend paying interest to banks and wealthy investors who buy the bonds, if it has to pay $1 trillion, and wait a minute, it's also paying over $1 trillion for war, $1 trillion for interest, that leaves maybe $1 trillion for everything else. Guess what? Everything else is going to be slashed. It's a contradiction in fiscal policy of major, major dimensions here. Neoliberal fiscal policy is crashing against a wall because fiscal policy, neoliberal fiscal policy, is to cut taxes for the rich and corporations and investors, right? And to increase and maintain war spending and to therefore try to make up for that lost revenue from tax hikes and spending by cutting social programs. That's neoliberal fiscal policy in a nutshell. And they ignored the consequences of that, which has to do with annual deficits and the debt, because it seemed they could get away with it when interest rates were near zero, but now they're not near zero. And now they're chronically high. Chronically high because inflation will remain chronically high, as I've said, particularly in the services sector. Once again, as I reported last show, I think, the July numbers for service prices in the Consumer Price Index was rising. In June, it was 5.3%. In July, it's 6.2%. So inflation is rising. for services, which is 80% of the U.S. economy. Now, goods inflation is not rising. Goods, things you buy, discrete things, you know, that's not rising. That's flat. Well, you could argue, you know, Fed rate hikes have dampened goods prices. You could also argue that the dampening of goods prices has to do with the slowing global economy, not the Fed rate hikes. But the slowing going global economy doesn't have that much effect on services. And Fed rate hikes have not had virtually any effect on services. Well, it's come down in some areas for services, but not very much. For the record rate hikes by the Fed, services inflation has barely budged. Now, we'll see if that's going to actually turn a corner in the next three to 6 months. But so far, the Fed rate hikes have been a failure as far as really bringing down services inflation. You could argue they brought down goods inflation, but then again, you know, that's ignoring the global economy slowdown. Okay, so budget cutting is coming. We saw budget cutting on social programs here in the debt ceiling negotiations several months ago, but that was only a high school play dress rehearsal. No, the big one is coming here next month, and that is the U.S. budget for 2024 is up for consideration October 1st, and the Republicans are sharpening the knives, and the Democrats are scratching their head, well, what can we cut? Because they'll agree to it, just as Biden agreed to it in the debt ceiling deal. You know, but this is the big one. This is the real slash and burn of social programs coming up. Because they will not raise taxes on the rich and the corporations to make up revenue to lower the deficit. And they will not stop throwing money at the Pentagon and wars to lower spending and lower the deficit. So those two major forces continue to drive the deficit over $1 trillion every year. And the interest on them is rising. As I said, and they have a real conundrum here. They, meaning capitalist policymakers, a real conundrum. How are they going to deal with these deficits and this debt when interest rates are rising and the cost of it is rising to unsustainable levels? Can they even cut social programs enough to make up for it? I don't think so. There's no way. Unless they want to throw everybody out on the street and cut all, and obviously, and take on Social Security. By the way, Social Security is not in the budget, you see. That's what's called non-discretionary spending. Discretionary spending is what is not locked in, you might say. Certain programs are locked in, like Social Security and pensions and so forth. That's locked in. And the annual budget is on discretionary spending, which is war, defense is part discretionary, of course, and then social programs are all discretionary. That's what they deal with, discretionary budget, which is like $3.3 trillion every year. That's the budget. But they're not bringing in enough revenue, because the economy is growing so slowly, and they won't do anything about tax cuts for the rich and the corporations except give them more. You see? That's what's going on here. It's a train wreck. It's a train running down the track, and the track is about to disappear, you see? And that's what we got going here on fiscal policy. And that's what Fitch looked at. And Fitch said, whoa, you know, I'm sure they wanted to downgrade more, but this political, you know, ramifications of doing so. So they just put a toe in the water, and they downgraded the U.S., which exacerbates the situation by raising rates, you see. Fed rates set the pace for other interest rates, you know, mortgage rates and prime rates and so forth in the private markets. What the Fed does with its interest rates is kind of like a benchmark that pushes up or down other interest rates in the private sector. Mortgage rates were already over 7% for mortgages. Only the rich are buying houses. Yeah. And reselling houses has nothing to do. That's called used goods to GDP. You know, it has to be new houses. And then, you know, new houses are only being built for the rich. Right? Which means that the affordability and the availability of lodging for everyone else is getting scarcer, which drives up rents and throws people on the street, homeless. Yeah, the very worst impacted, very low wage people making no money, you know, they end up on the street. The working class has to tighten its belt and pay higher rent and higher mortgage variable rates if they have them. Right? The middle class, you might say. Okay. It's one of the grand contradictions of neoliberal policy, fiscal, in the area of fiscal policy, right? They can't keep these tax cuts. They can't keep war spending and defense spending rising without continuing $1 trillion a year annual deficits, which add to this run-up in the debt. National debt, $34 trillion, going to $43. And the interest on the debt, you see, those economists who argue that, oh, you know, the debt doesn't matter. Well, what matters is the interest payment on the debt, because as that rises, it will crowd out other spending. And, of course, they're not going to let it crowd out defense war spending, but they'll take on the rest of the discretionary spending budget, and I predict they're going to have to go after Social Security, which is non-discretionary. It has nothing to do with the budget deficit, but they'll take it on anyway and argue that they reduced it that way. Yeah, that's coming. That's coming. Okay. That's the analysis of the Fitch, the repercussions, the implications of the Fitch decision. Bottom line, it exacerbates the fiscal crisis of neoliberalism. It exacerbates it significantly, right? Now, in the past, we talked about the crisis neoliberal monetary policy. Remember, we talked about that, and that also has its set of contradictions. If you remember, what we've been saying repeatedly is that the Fed raises interest rates to dampen inflation. It increases the potential for bank and financial instability. Well, we've seen at 5% Fed rates, you know, the policy rate as they call it, in just a year from March 22 to March to June, July, 15 months, we've seen record interest rates. We're at 5.5% for the base rate, the policy rate. Yeah. Record pace of increase and level. And I've been saying all along that, you know, you hit 5 to 6%, you're causing banking instability. And we saw that emerge in March with the regional banking crisis, which is not over, by the way. Why isn't it over? Well, the Fed is, to use a silly metaphor, the little Dutch boy with his finger in the dike, in the hole in the dike, right? Remember that when you were a kid, you know? the Fed's got its thumb stuck in a hole here by providing $95 billion at one point a week to the regional banking system. FDIC providing a little bit more as well to keep the regional banks afloat because of interest rate risk. And those interest rates are too high. And some of these banks got overexposed to crypto and tech and so forth. And I say next, overexposed to commercial real estate. They're overexposed, and their depositors see that, and they're taking their money out. Deposits are flooding out of the regional banks still. And the Fed policy is, immediately we're going to throw money into the hole here to offset the loss of these deposits. And in the meantime, we're going to try to take the worst, most unstable of these banks and merge them with other banks, you know, get J.P. Morgan Chase to buy them, you know, which is they did. And also to get these banks to sell off their best assets to the shadow banks, you know, BlackRock and all those guys, to raise some cash so we don't have to throw as much in. That's what's going on case by case behind the scenes, and the Fed's throwing money into it. They can lose control of that if we have the other shoe of instability, financial instability fall, which is the commercial real estate market. I think $17 trillion. I think regional banks are exposed, or just the U.S. banks. I'm not sure. The big banks are okay, but it's the regional banks. $17 trillion exposed to loans to the commercial real estate market, which is unstable because it's got to roll over its debt here starting fourth quarter and next year. Trillions of dollars have to be rolled over. In other words, loans have to be reissued, pay off the old ones, issue new ones. But if the banks don't want to pay off or loan anymore to the commercial real estate companies, real estate investment trusts, and so forth, well, then they don't get their loans. They go bankrupt. But that's a problem because then if they go bankrupt, the lenders, the regional banks are in trouble too with great losses. So it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of a thing. But it's coming, particularly in the office sector and the malls. You know, those are the two sectors of commercial real estate that are really exposed and unstable. Because one of the impacts, in part at least, of COVID is people not working in the big cities. You know, like in San Francisco, the occupancy rate for these offices downtown is like 70% or less. Yeah, they're a third vacant. And by the way, you know, when you have that much downtown center vacancy, you have that many fewer workers and that many fewer workers who are shopping around and eating around and so forth. And then it spills over to real retail businesses were shut down too. Well, that's going on in San Francisco, big exodus of retail companies leaving because the business just isn't there for other reasons too. That's a consequence of the commercial real estate sector instability, which will eventually impact on the regional banks here, I predict, in 6 to 12 months. Now, that's a contradiction for Fed monetary policy, right? I mean, basically, the contradiction neoliberal policy is, you got to raise rates to try to dampen inflation, and the Fed has done that record level. Right, with minimal success, by the way, as far as services are concerned, services costs, prices. But that's exacerbated interest rate risk for the weak sisters in the banking system. And I've said always that if the Fed raises rates 6%, 5.5%, 6%, it's going to really provoke financial instability. And the Fed knows this, I think. That's why it's kind of stopping. I don't think you're going to see any more Fed rate hikes for a while. But that doesn't mean that private interest rates don't continue to rise. They will. And that doesn't mean that Fed rates won't rise, even though the Fed does not raise its base policy rate. In other words, interest rates are caused not only by decisions influencing the money supply, which is what the Fed does, you see, by buying and selling bonds, the Fed puts money into the banking system or takes money out of the banking system. It manages the money supply that way, or influences the money supply that way. Well, interest rates are just the price of money. And supply affects the price of anything, in this case, the price of money, but demand also affects the price. You see, a lot of mainstream economists, they just focus on the supply side of money here as a determinant of interest, not on the demand side. I mean, it's economics 101. Supply and demand fundamentally affect price. But they think that simply by changing the supply of money through Fed action, you know, that the price, the interest rate, the price of money, can be manipulated. Well, you can't manipulate demand for money. That's due to broader economic forces that the Fed has no control over. And money demand here plays at least as great a role in interest rates. And what I'm saying is that the demand for money, for dollars here, will continue to drive private sector rates higher, regardless of what the Fed does with its policy rate and its manipulation of supply money. Regardless. Another contradiction, in other words. Now, by raising interest rates, you know, the Fed faces this contradiction, must raise rates to try to dampen inflation. It's been not that effective, but the more they raise it, the more they exacerbate potential bank instability, right? That's the contradiction. Damned if you do one in the other. And of course, there's feedback effects between the two, right? Has the Fed rate increases really been that effective even in dampening inflation? I've been saying no, you know, because look at the statistic. Services prices actually rising, right? Goods inflation flat. But once again, is that because of Fed rate hikes or the global economy slowing? And we're seeing new forces pushing up prices that the Fed has no control over. In other words, inflation is chronic, and it may even be rising. Well, what are these new forces? Well, OPEC is raising the price of crude oil again, and we're beginning to see it spill over to gasoline at the pump, aren't we? Yeah. Gasoline prices here in the U.S., particularly in California, are approaching $6 a gallon again. And we've got corporate price gouging going on. The Fed rate hikes have nothing to do with that. They can't handle that. We've got productivity collapse in this country, which raises the unit labor costs, which then get passed on into higher prices, right? And now we're going to start seeing, slowly but surely, a decline in demand for the U.S. dollar globally. Well, if the demand for the dollar falls, right, then the price of the dollar will fall and, you know, the cost of the dollar will rise, interest rates will rise. All of things equal, of course. Well, why is that? Why? What's going on here? Well, that's because U.S. sanctions policies, you know, particularly against Russia and China, are backfiring the Biden administration. They're leading to an undermining of the U.S. dollar in the global market. Undermining it. Well, what does it mean to say undermining it? These countries are now, starting later in August, going to start trading with each other, goods and services with each other, not using the dollar. You see, part of the global empire is the linchpin is the U.S. dollar. The dollar used to be necessary for all global trading. Virtually, it's the global trading currency. That's been slowly slipping over decades, but still dominant. The dollar is the global trading and reserve, in other words, holding dollar as a value in your accounts, but using it, trading currency, using it to buy and sell. All oil, energy products used to be traded in the dollar. They're not anymore. Industrial commodities, metals of various kinds, copper, aluminum, right? Iron ore, etc. Agricultural products, grains, right? Soybeans, wheat, corn, etc. All in the dollar, or virtually all in the dollar. But because of sanctions, the sanctions policy, which the U.S. has been part of U.S. policy since 1959, sanctions against Cuba, but really intensified here and never before used the way it's being used now in Russia, against Russia. Sanctions have led to a growing number of countries called the BRICS. BRICS, that's an acronym, B-R-I-C-S, stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, getting together and saying, well, we're going to start trading with another currency. And other countries joining the BRICS now, in various stages of application to join the BRICS, agreeing to do that. Even Saudi Arabia agreeing to sell oil to China using the Chinese yuan. Whoa! What this means is that increasingly, global trade will not use the U.S. dollar. Now, if the U.S. dollar is not used, then the demand for dollars in global trade, demand for dollars will go down. When demand goes down in anything, the price goes down. The dollar will decline in price chronically, significantly, as more and more countries around the world use alternative currency. Well, what's that alternative currency? Well, it's probably a basket of currencies and gold mixed together as the reserve instead of using the dollar. So the demand for dollar will result in the decline of the value of dollar, which means import prices to the U.S. will rise. It'll cost more. When the dollar declines in value, import prices rise, which contribute to inflation, chronic inflation in the U.S. So sanctions have shot. The Biden administration and the sanctions have not had the effect on Russia or China that they're talking about or saying it will. But they have shot themselves in the foot, maybe both feet, here with these sanctions, because it's undermining their empire. It's undermining the dollar, the linchpin of their empire. The dummies. Yeah. Well, you know, foreign policy is run by neocons in this country, you know, Blinken, Sullivan, Newland, and all those characters. And Joe goes along with the show. I don't know if he agrees with him or he just doesn't know what the hell's happening. I mean, he can't even walk off a dais now or read a teleprompter. I don't know, you know, whether he's totally in command here. He's manipulable, that's for sure. And these sanctions things are a creation of the neocons. Oh, they're going to bring Russia's economy to its knees. No indicator shows Russian economy is in trouble. I mean, they got more revenue from oil. You know, their dollar, their currency is up. Interest rates are being lowered, et cetera. You know, unemployment is low. Total failure. Sanctions have been total failure against Russia. But they have convinced more and more countries around the world that, oh, we can't, with the dollar, we're in trouble. You see, because the dollar, buying and selling the dollar, uses the what's called the SWIFT. That's another acronym, S-W-I-F-T, International Payment System, which is really run by U.S. banks. And the SWIFT International Payment System allows U.S. banks to see who's violating the sanctions. But if you have another currency, you will have another alternative payment system, not the SWIFT, and the U.S. won't be able to see who's violating the sanctions. You see, that's another consequence of why sanctions will fail, are failing. But this is a big deal. They're undermining their own global linchpin, the dollar, with these sanctions policies. And lowering the dollar, lowering demand for the dollar, will lower the value of the dollar, will raise import inflation in the U.S. Another contradiction, a neoliberal policy, you see. In the show I did a couple weeks ago or months ago, check it out. I talk about the four elements, key elements of neoliberal policy, and how three of them at least are breaking down. International policy, fiscal policy, monetary policy are facing growing contradictions and complications. Only industrial policy seems to be working of the four policies associated with neoliberalism. In greater detail, I go into this all in my 2020 book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism. Industrial policy may be at a turning point as well here. We'll see. But that's been the most successful for neoliberalism and the most stable going forward, right? Okay, so also a consequence of the declining dollar, value of the dollar, right, is and the demand for the dollar is U.S. exports will slow. And that means the real economy, not just inflation rising, import prices rising, but export sales from U.S. companies in the U.S. Will slow, all things equal, as well. So that will lower GDP. So raise inflation and lowering GDP. Right. Okay, I want to talk briefly about the jobs numbers today. The jobs numbers today. Again, the Fed has said all along that the way to slow inflation is to raise interest rates to cause layoffs, and layoffs means less wage income and less demand for goods and services, and therefore prices will come down. Well, how many jobs created in July? Whether they're created or not is another question. Okay, total non-farm employment, 218,000 again. Private sector jobs, 187,000. Virtually all those jobs increases have come in the services sector. So the Fed Chairman Powell targeting services, we got to mean services unemployment here to lower wages and prices, has not worked. The unemployment rate has been unchanged for a year, despite over this year rapid record increases in interest rates. Other labor market indicators have not changed either, not just the unemployment rate. The jobs numbers have been chronic. Labor force participation has barely budged. Right. So, if the Fed said that the target was services because prices of goods had come down, we need more layoffs on unemployment. It hasn't happened. Well, not surprisingly, services inflation has risen because that hasn't happened, right? Which leads us to say that maybe Fed interest rate hikes have no effect on the labor market, at least the services sector of the labor market, because jobs keep being created in the labor market. 154,000 of the 187,000 jobs were in the private services sector last month. Yeah. Record rate hikes, no effect, or little effect, some effect, but little effect on the services sector. You know, in economic parlance, this means that the elasticity of interest rate hikes on employment in the service sector is very low. It takes a lot of rate hikes to get less and less of a effect on employment and services and therefore wages. Yeah. That's called inelastic. It's inelastic. A big change in interest rates brings a smaller change than before in jobs, right? And therefore in prices in services, right? Well, that means it's Fed rate hikes are ineffective. Well, that means they got to raise them even more, but they can't because they will provoke worse banking instability. You see, they're between a rock and a hard place. They can't go any more than 5.5-6% rate hikes to reduce employment in services and therefore wages and prices in services. They can't do it because they'll shoot themselves in the other foot and cause more banking instability, right? You could argue that the Fed rate hikes have had an effect on the goods sector, producing goods, things, right? You could argue that, but then how do you explain the slowing global economy effect on the same? How do you separate out the two effects? No one's doing that. Okay, so bottom line, nothing has changed with this latest jobs report. Over the last 6 months in particular, it's the same job. Nothing has really changed. And that includes the service sector jobs keep growing. And inflation keeps growing in services. I would say that's a failure of monetary policy, a failure. Definitely. A growing contradiction and a failure. The Fed cannot raise rate hikes. Well, destabilizing financial system even more. But if it doesn't raise rates even more, service jobs will continue. Okay, next week I want to talk about labor exploitation. So join us next week for this critical discussion. All right, I'm out of here.